Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production.
Now available on Apple Podcasts,
Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Look, if you're hungry right now, I got a solution for you. Let me tell you about Good Ranchers. They got the best meat in the country because Good Ranchers began with the standard of bringing top quality 100% American-born, raised at harvested meat to families across America. This vision was instilled into them from their grandparents that owned community grocery stores and believed in trust, charity, American values. Maybe you're a college student and you're tired of just eating the endless piles of garbage they feed you. Maybe you're a single mother and you just want to be able to feed your kids good protein. Or maybe you're a father with an obligation to put food on the table. Well, why don't you put meat on the table from goodranchers.com. You get 100% American-raised beef right to your door. Beef the way it used to be. I'm a big beef fan. I love meat. It's very important that you have good meat, and that's what Good Ranchers is all about. Goodranchers.com is 100% American beef, chicken, and more, and you can support American farmers who support the American economy. Don't waste your money on cheap cuts or the overseas stuff. Come on, buy American, everybody. Get the good cuts your family deserves at goodranchers.com. They deliver your favorite meats right to your door and use the promo code Charlie, C-H-A-R-L-I-E, to save $20 off your purchase. That's goodranchers.com right now. Use the promo code Charlie. Save $20 for a limited time only. Goodranchers.com, promo code Charlie.
Charlie, what's up, brother? Glad to be joining you today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I got to admit, you look like you've been running around quite a bit. I know we had to reschedule a couple of times, and while I can appreciate that, but it seems like you're a busy man these days.
Yeah, doing two podcasts today, one on Saturday, one on Sunday, trying to get the president reelected and still run Turning Point USA and Turning Point Action and speaking. And so, but we're glad we made this work.
How do you do it all, man? That's what I want to know. I've got four kids. I've been married for 16 years. I'm running two different businesses. And I think I'm running at about half of what you're running at, and even I feel overwhelmed. So tell me your secret.
Well, the four kids, I don't know if I'd be able to do that. That sounds like quite a lot. Hopefully there'll be kids coming soon. I don't know. Who knows my life? I don't know. But look, I really, really love what I get to do. I don't love some of the things I have to do it, such as traveling. I don't like that. Cross-country flights, the sleepless nights, red eyes, you know, checking in a new hotel. I don't like that, the kind of the technical part of it, but I really love pursuing ideas. I love convincing people. I love being challenged. And that just motivates you. You know, I'm up till midnight, 1 o'clock, 1:30 every night, and then just up, you know, 7 o'clock, 6:37. And that's on a good night. That's sleeping in, by the way. And but we have a great team. I'm very disciplined with how I spend my time. I really don't do anything that isn't pertinent to the mission. The only thing I would do, I'll work out 5 or 6 days a week. That's about it. But I don't do video games. You know, I don't really have leisure activities. You know, people say, what do you do for fun? I don't really do that. You know, I kind of just do the mission. And so when you're there, we actually have more time in a day than I think people realize. I think that most people waste so much time. So yeah, I'm incredibly blessed. Wrote a book this year, made bestseller, you know, did the podcast thing. Now it's turning into a radio show. We were doing three podcasts a week. Now we're doing 12 podcasts a week.
I knew that.
So
it's wild, man.
Yeah. Not to mention the longer form interviews. And in a regular year, I'd be doing 300 speeches a year. Probably not going to hit it this year for obvious reasons. But I'm actually on pace. If I were to keep the pace I'm on right now, I'd be doing more than 350. But no, look, I love what I get to do. I'm incredibly blessed and just very thankful.
The term I use is integrated, and it sounds like you're very integrated with your work and your life, and there's not a bunch of different hats. Like a lot of men will talk about hats. I got to wear the family hat, the dad hat, the work hat, And I found in my own personal life that if I don't pretend like I'm wearing different hats, but instead say I'm one man, whether I'm at work, whether I'm with my family, whether I'm with my friends, or in my own leisure activities, there's a lot of congruency and integration between the way I live my life. And that's much more efficient than trying to put on different hats and pretend like I'm somebody different in each circumstance.
Yeah, and I have the opportunity to not have to be somebody different. I mean, one of the greatest gifts that God has given me is I say the same things publicly as I do privately, because that's I'm in the business of speaking and I'm in the business of idea advancement. So people come to me and they say, Charlie, you know, I'm a lawyer at this law firm, a partner. I own this business and I wish I could be you because you're able to say the same thing in a work setting that you're able to say in a private setting. And so that kind of, as you say, congruency is actually very liberating. I don't have to pretend to be somebody in a different environment. And also, I just have decided to completely disassociate myself with anyone that is any form of nastiness or vitriol, just as a compulsory friendship. I've just discontinued those. It is
which, you know, it's funny. It's funny you say that because, look, I see you in videos. I see you on the socials and you have immersed yourself in, frankly, what I would consider nastiness, frankly, you know, with the rallies you go to and on campus and what you subject yourself to. I don't know if I can handle it. Is that because of your mission? Is that your purpose? Like, what keeps you going in those hostile environments?
Yeah, I actually kind of enjoy the idea collision because I actually think it's good for our country to have different ideas be presented against each other. I don't love being screamed at by some of these apparatchiks. I mean, I'm not a sociopath, so it's not something I find enjoyment about. But I will say that I do think that it's beneficial when those conversations are occurring and happening, the millions of people that might be watching them in the future. So when I go to a campus and some lunatic is screaming in my ear and about how awful of a person I am and all these sorts of things, at least I can have some form of peace that if I'm filming it, somebody might learn something from this in the future. And so that kind of makes it in some ways worthwhile. However, I wish what I was saying wasn't so deemed disagreeable. I actually think what I'm saying is pretty normal stuff. And it's just the Overton window has changed so dramatically in our country that if you dare say there are only two genders or that there's a war on men or that we shouldn't judge people based on their skin color, you're all of a sudden deemed worthy of cancellation and outrage. And I obviously don't subscribe to that. So I think, and again, it's a mission-driven thing. I actually really believe in this stuff, which is what drives me to continue to do it.
You know, it's funny you talk about these ideas that I think, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago weren't controversial. You know, I think about myself. I have four kids. I already told you that. I believe in God. I believe men are men and women are women. I believe in traditional family values. I wouldn't have thought that that would be counterculture. I've never considered myself a rebel. But it seems to me that now more than ever that I'm the rebellious one because I have all of these traditional values. And it's a very interesting thing that these types of things that we know with 100% certainty lead men and families and women and society to a better life have become controversial.
That's right. And now all of a sudden, those of us that believe in taking responsibility for yourself and for your family, not blaming other people for your circumstances, applying yourself correctly, finding a good and moral aim, all of a sudden this is considered to be controversial. And I think it's actually really dangerous for our country to do that and for our civilization to do that. I mean, if you're now married and you are faithful to that person with children, you are now the exception, not the rule.
Right.
That's really an incredible thing when you think about it. And it's also a very dangerous thing. And so you also asked early on, you know, how am I able to do it? It's also what I don't do. I haven't had a drink in a very, very long time. You know, I think that if you look at successful people, obviously don't do drugs or any of that. But for myself, I would not be able to do what I do if I were to be doing the substances that most of the people in this world do. And I think that there's a lesson here that a lot of people need to realize that there's a reason why they're trying to tell you to do alcohol all the time. There's a reason why they're trying to do that. And it's really to keep you down. And I think that you can actually become a much more, and again, I'm not actually morally against drinking. Let me be very clear. I'm not trying to make people feel bad if they're doing that. I'm purely talking about it from a utilitarian perspective. Just let me be very clear that I don't think I biochemically would be able to do what I do if I indulged in the same form of casual drinking that most of the country has been in the last 6 months in particular.
Yeah, I agree. I think what a lot of men do is they sedate themselves because, you know, the reality of their situations are difficult and demanding, and they learn from their parents and they learn from society because we have this entire generation of fatherless homes, how to respond to difficult circumstances. You know, and all of us have difficult circumstances, whether it's the wake of COVID or, you know, we've lost a job or we deal with a family with a medical condition. It's such a travesty that so many men have not learned to address this in a positive manner, and instead have learned that the way you deal with it is to sedate yourself. And that's what I see more and more of.
Yeah. And look, nothing good happens after you're drunk. And that a lot of people that make it is truly, and I hate to use this term because it's overused, it's a gateway to other bad things. You will make other say things you don't mean. You might hurt somebody you don't mean to hurt, both physically or otherwise. And then it also makes you less responsible, more likely to fall into a pattern of behavior that you're not going to be able to take responsibility for your actions. And again, I'm not morally against it. I want to be very clear. I'm not trying to make anyone, you know, feel worse if they're doing that thing. I'm just saying it actually will make you in the long term a much unhappier, much more unhappy and less likely to be able to take the meaningful type of responsibility you need to in your life to be able to succeed.
Yeah, I like this because I think what we hear a lot from, you know, the quote unquote self-help gurus is here's what you need to do. Have a schedule, work a plan, be disciplined, and all the things that you should do. And none of those are wrong.
I agree with that.
But we don't hear from those of us who tell us, okay, well, here's what you need to eliminate from your life. Eliminate the sedation, eliminate the toxicity, eliminate those friends who aren't serving you. So you can free up a path to be able to pursue, like you talked about, your mission, whatever it is for you.
Completely. Yeah. And so, I mean, again, I'm someone that has a great passion for what I get to do. I do it every single day. There are no days off. I don't have more talent than anyone else in this space, but I outwork everybody. And I don't mean that braggadociously. It's just, we have done that for 7.5, 8 years, and we're going to continue to do that.
Let me pause you right there, Charlie. Let me ask you about your work ethic, because I recognize that to be true. Is that something that is innate within you, or is that something you've developed? That's something I feel like I have as well, but I don't know if everybody has that same sort of drive and desire to just grind it out. And it seems like you do.
Most people don't. And I don't know where it came from. My parents always taught me and showed me what hard work looks like. My father, being an architect, would work till 1:30 in the morning every single morning for most of my life. He'd come home for dinner and then go back to work till 1:30, then wake up at 8 a.m. and do it all over again. That was the kind of culture I grew up around. And I mean, just looking at my high school life, I was always signing up for more activities, always working harder. I don't know if it's built into you. I can't quite pinpoint it. All I know is that I have known nothing my entire life other than being hyperactive and apps. And there's a really important thing though. Some of these people will go to some of these conferences that you just mentioned and they'll be fired up and they will start putting in those long hours. But the minute that any sort of adversity hits them, it's brittle and they shatter. And so it's not just being able to put in the long hours and work till 11 p.m. every single night and wake up at 6 a.m. and work Saturdays and work Sundays and do not drink and don't do drugs and stop watching mindless television and get rid of your video games, all that sort of stuff, right? Again, if you're able to do a great life with those things, terrific. I love freedom. So good for you. I'm just telling you what works for me, right? And so I don't mean this in a way where I'm trying to make someone feel bad or you're a bad person. I'm going to keep saying that because sometimes people read into it too much.
I think our listeners here are, they're a little bit more aware than that, they're willing to take things in context.
I get these messages where people say, well, you know, people say, well, Charlie, do you think I'm a bad person because I have a beer once a week? It's like, I've never said that. Okay.
People are incapable of context and discernment for sure. Okay.
That's good. And so, but to go a step further and a level deeper on this though, if we kind of look at people need to go to self-help exercise and they have no capacity to withstand suffering. The hardest thing to do is to keep going when you really come across something that requires perseverance, when you have someone betray you, when you have someone come after you that wants to destroy your career, when you have a contract fall through, when you have a project that doesn't go the way you wanted it to, when you get a very angrily worded email from a donor in our world, you know, in our nonprofit world, that's
right,
you know, who we raise money from. How do you deal when that happens? And that's really when your toughness comes through. And we have created one of the most fragile generations in the history of humanity. We've done it through our school system. We've done it through our pop culture. We've done it through a variety of different ways. And I know the name of this program is The Order of Man, but just for young men out there, we have fully grown infants. Most young men in our country are not young men. They do not deserve that title. They are responsible for nothing. They have no direction at all whatsoever in their life. They have no capacity to be able to endure opposition or suffering. They have no direction and no aim whatsoever. And they're just infants. They are fully grown infants that are wholly subsidized by their parents or by a masculine woman. Look, here's the thing about home security companies. Most trap you with very high prices, tricky contracts, and lousy customer support, the worst. So while there's a lot of options out there, there's only one no-brainer to keep your family safe from criminals. The thugs are walking the streets, maybe coming after your family. You have to keep your family safe. That's why you need SimpliSafe. Look, crime is up huge percentages in New York and Los Angeles. They're breaking into homes. They're taking people's stuff. That's why you need SimpliSafe. SimpliSafe has everything you need to protect your home with none of the drawbacks of traditional home security. It has an arsenal of sensors and cameras to blanket every room, window and door tailored specifically. Look, I like partnering with SimpliSafe because I know it keeps you safe. I use SimpliSafe for all the property that I care about, and you can set it up in under an hour. All this starts at $15 a month. There's no contract, no pushy sales guys, no hidden fees, no fine print. They are in the business of keeping your family and your loved ones safe. So try SimpliSafe today at simplisafe.com/Charlie. You get a free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. There's nothing to lose. That's simplisafe.com/Charlie.
It's a great point, and this is exactly why we make the distinction between males and men. You know, I look at my boys, for example. I've got three boys and I've got one little girl, and I look at my boys and nobody expects them to be men. They're immature. They're overly emotional. They throw temper tantrums occasionally. They don't know how to respond to situations with dignity and class and intelligence. Nobody expects them to. But it would be a shame if I saw my young boys grow into adult age without learning how to mature. The question I have is, how do we begin to foster this in a generation of young boys and girls who are growing up without fathers?
Yeah, it's really hard because then the women have no aim to go marry and the men have no aim to go to basically harmonize with or try to embody, right? So women need strong fathers because they want a role model to be able to eventually go marry somebody like that.
Sure.
And then men, and that's not the only reason, by the way. That's just that's one of the most important reasons. And then a young boy needs a male father figure so he knows what to aspire to. So he knows what to try to become. And when you break that down, your civilization will start to fall apart. But it's also, I see two-parent households where the roles are reversed, where the female has become the male and the man has become the woman. And it is masculine women and feminine men. And you kind of hear the stereotype on some comedy shows and stuff, but it's actually really true, which is the kind of metropolitan beta male, where if you looked hard, you couldn't find an ounce of testosterone in some of these men, and they take responsibility for nothing. And they've almost kind of turned themselves into this androgynous, very unclear form of a once man, now newly found woman. And that's a very dangerous thing for a country and for a civilization. And so what do we do for young men? And I know this. Look, so first of all, we are over-medicating young men. That's number one.
No doubt. No doubt.
We don't talk about this enough. If I would have grown up today, I would have been on ADHD or ADD, I should say, attention deficit disorder medication. You heard my schedule. I can't find enough stuff to do. I love being active. School is not designed for people like me. I could never sit still in second, third, and fourth grade. I could never focus on what the teacher was telling me. I would always be active. I'd be up on my feet. That's just who I am. And that's how a lot of young boys are. But my parents, to their credit, despite the pill pushers and people trying to intersect themselves, said, we are not putting our kid on medication. He'll grow up. He'll find his voice. He'll be fine. That was the best thing they could have done for me. Whereas now someone like me, you know what should worry everyone? There are thousands of people like Charlie Kirk that are being medicated right now because parents are not holding the line against the over medication push in our country.
And I would say, Charlie, on that is, I know you're a big fan of making sure we use the right verbiage. And so you're saying over medication, and technically that's true, but I would say it's more over sedation. Can you imagine sedating a child, you know, an 8-year-old child who's got creativity and passion and enthusiasm, and you say to yourself, if you had to recognize it for what it truly was, say, you know what? I don't like all that passion. Let's strip away a little bit of that passion by popping you full of pills so that you'll, you know, conform and toe the line and do what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah. So yeah, you're right. Sedation's absolutely a better term. And look, if someone has a legitimate medical condition unrelated to their capacity to not focus, but what happens is the entire school system's been feminized. It's designed for women by women to be taught by women and for women. That's fine. Women are much more agreeable than men, and boys in particular are incredibly disagreeable. They can't sit still. They need to be involved in the learning process. That's why recess is important for young boys and not as important for young women. And so young women are thriving in our country. And in fact, I would make the argument that every metric that they're thriving at is not, it's actually in some ways at the expense at times of men. And that I'm not saying that women are the problem, but the fact when 60% of college graduates are now women, that's not, that there's no equilibrium there. And that comes at some expense because the school system has been so hyper-feminized, where young women are more than willing to sit and go through an entire class without moving. A fourth grader, a young boy, forget it. That's not what, for 2 hours, that's asking a lot out of a young boy.
I mean, I can't even do that as an almost 40-year-old man at this point. So let alone an 8-year-old child.
Let alone in the digital age where they have a dopamine rush every time that their phone bings. And I'll get into that in a second if you want to go in that direction. Where also additionally to that, so what do we do for young boys? Let me just kind of go back. So we're overly sedating them. We're hyper-feminizing their learning environment. And also the way that we educate them just through the curriculum is absolute garbage. Young men from a very young boys from a young age are being taught that men are the enemy and women are good and you must make yourself more feminine in nature. This is garbage. It's nonsense. It's foolish. For example, the literature that we teach young boys that they have to read, they don't want to read Little House on the Prairie. They would rather read a biography about Teddy Roosevelt. And sure. So biographies are the best way to get young boys' attention. Why? Because young boys want somebody to emulate. They want a hero. They want to resonate with that. Why does Little House on the Prairie resonate with young women? They want a family to nurture, and young, they're much more relational. So books that are much more in dialogue form, women do a lot better when they're in the fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. Much more the adventure form, young boys do a lot better. That's why Mark Twain was such an incredibly important author for the formation and the hero spirit for our country. We don't teach that anymore because they used a word they don't like. I mean, just grow up. And so that's other thing. And then finally, if I had to put like third, the first being sedation, second, hyperfemination of our schools/curriculum. The third thing is this, is that we do not challenge young men for their call to adventure. Young men need to be challenged. And I mean this. This is why football is such an important part of our country, and they're trying to destroy that too. I don't think football is for everyone, but it was important for me. I could tell you in my life, when I was an eighth grader, football really made me grow up very quickly, saying yes, sir, no, sir, to a strong male figure that made you be on the line at the exact time, being able to run wind sprints, hierarchy, order, discipline. For me, football really got me in the line. For all that distracted energy that I had in the classroom, I had meaning. I had fulfillment. I had camaraderie. And you know what? The physical combativeness, I loved that, right? I loved being able to get out and have the blood flowing and testosterone. That was awesome. And again, it's not for everybody. I fully recognize that. But I can tell you it made me a more complete and fuller human being. And so we don't do that kind of call to adventure as much anymore. And outside of the football analogy, We need to be challenging 16-year-olds to take responsibility for their life. Here's how you treat women. Here's how you talk. Here's how you communicate. Here's how you sit up straight with your shoulders back. You look clearly in people's eyes. All those sorts of things are completely lost. And now we have, and Jordan Peterson has said this so many times, we have the Peter Pan equivalent of the Lost Boys. We have tens of millions of fully mature infants or males that are not men that have no responsibility. They own nothing. They're full of substances. They're overweight. They have no direction. And they're cowards. And I can go into that further as to why that obviously the problem, I think, is pretty self-evident.
Yeah, I like the Lost Boys analogy. The analogy I've used quite often too is Lord of the Rings, you know, where you know, you don't, or excuse me, Lord of the Flies, sorry, where you don't have.
Yeah, it's exactly the same. Yeah. No, I mean, Lord of the Flies and Lost Boys are exactly the same.
Exactly.
Type of idea where you're governed by the infants, basically.
Right, right. And so what happens without that clear male, masculine, authoritative figure is they begin to take it upon themselves. And this is, I think, a big reason why we see the rioting and the vandalism and the violence and the looting,
totally.
Because these young men, these boys, regardless of what age they are, have never learned to toe the line. You know, you talk about football. I had a football coach who got in my face. I remember when I went to basic training, I saw the guys that I went to basic training with. I could tell you just in the first 24 hours who was accustomed to having another grown man up in their face yelling at them and who was never accustomed to that. Who grew up without a father, who grew up without playing sports. I could tell because they broke within a 24-hour time frame versus the men who played sports, who had dads in their lives, were unbreakable, were unshatterable at that point. I like the term you use, brittle, right?
And so what the feminists have done and the weak men is they say that that's inherently abusive. Look, I had coaches that probably borderlined on abusive, and I don't mean physically, okay? I don't. But emotionally, they really pushed the envelope on that. It made me a stronger person, okay? It did. Made me a stronger person. However, I wouldn't wish that upon somebody else. However, they were the minority. The vast majority of the coaches I had, they pushed me to the level to make me better. They, when they screamed and yelled at me, it wasn't that I was scared. It was they wanted you to get to that next level. They wanted you to become a stronger person. They expected you to take responsibility for yourself. And so what the feminists have done is they say all of that moral discipline, all of that male involvement, all of it is wrong because of the few examples of abuse. Therefore, we must feminize everything. Like, no, that's a really bad idea. Okay. In fact, it's a civilizational ending bad idea. Somebody said something to me the other day, and I don't really remember what it was. It might have been at a Starbucks or something, where someone said, "Man, I have to go adult today." I said, "Excuse me? And you've heard this verb, or like whatever, it's a noun, adult. I guess I have to go adult.
Right.
A verb. It would be a verb. Yeah. I have to go adult. It's something I have to do." And I said, "Do you mean that in a negative sense?" Like, "Yeah, I don't really want to do it." I said, and I thought to myself, I said, "Okay." I just ended the conversation. And I really sat down, I turned off my phone. I thought to myself for like 5 minutes because I was just so, it was just such a train wreck. Like, this is how you destroy your entire civilization when someone thinks that adulting is bad.
Bad.
I got to go adult right now. Basically, and it goes back to a philosopher by the name of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. A lot of the American left, and I don't want to over-politicize this, it's just true. A lot of the political left believes in this, which is they prefer the infant over the adult and the primitive over the civilized. He wrote that explicitly. Jean-Jacques Rousseau did. And he inspired Karl Marx. And that is exactly where they want young boys to stay, is in this state of perpetual infancy.
You know, it's funny you talk about this. We'll use the term. I don't even know if I want to use this term. I was going to say emotional abuse. But you have these coaches, right, that were towing the line. But what's interesting is you have women who are
–
yeah, I get it. I understand. And I've been there too. I've had great coaches and I've had dicks and I've had everywhere in between.
Yeah, precisely. But you know what? You kind of become tougher because of it, to be honest. So anyway.
Right. As long as you have the balance of the proper type of coaching to outweigh the negative coaching.
Because
otherwise
yes.
It becomes abuse, right? And then
and
you start to buy into
thing.
It.
Yeah. No. Yeah. And I think that critique is a valid one by the people that are saying, I think a critique either internally or externally, that's a valid one. What I think the prescription to try to fix it is to abolish all hierarchies of male pouring into young people is a disaster. And that's where they go immediately. But anyway, the same can be said though for terrorizing women, where women can terrorize other women and where teachers or whatever, older sisters to younger sisters, girlfriends to girlfriends, or for women teachers to male students. So it's not exclusively this idea.
I mean, you're exactly right. The emotional manipulation that I've seen in some women just in hearing conversations with men is absolutely insane. And frankly, right. Society has bought into that generally. You look at, for example, the family court system and this level of emotional manipulation from women to ostracize men from their children, for example, is a real threat, not only to those men and their children, but to society in general. So I think women are just as guilty. And I'm not putting it all on them, but just as guilty of emotional manipulation as any man could be.
Yeah, and the idea that one sex or one gender has a monopoly on the manipulation exercise is foolish, and it doesn't look at any sort of reality or empirical experience at all. It's anti-empiricist. And so, yeah, and look, so when you ask yourself, how do we create stronger men? How do we create a country where we have men take responsibility. First of all, parents need to do a much better job, and most of them aren't. They're doing a horrendous job. Young men should not get a smartphone until they're 16 or 17 or 18. It's that simple. Do not give them a phone. These things are designed and programmed to have you be slaves to the Silicon Valley tech oligarchs. They are designed to be biochemically addictive, no different than big tobacco. They've admitted this in congressional testimonies that they have created these devices to be addictive for young people. If you're a parent out there, take the phone away from your kid if they are not 16 years old and go buy them a jitterbug, which is just a phone that they can call you in a time of emergency. That's how I grew up, and praise God it was that way. If I would have grown up in today's society getting phones when kids are 8, 9, 10 years old, I would have been a wreck. I would have been a quasi-cyborg where a lot of these people are being raised.
I agree. For my two oldest, we have these gizmo watches is what they're called. So they're just a watch. They're synced to our data plan or whatever. And they can call me, my wife, and maybe two or mm-hmm. three other people. And there's a few little minor games, but all of the games on there are centered around physical activity. So it's like, how many jumps can you do in 60 seconds, right? But sure. Outside of that, no access to anything else, because I just think there is a larger plan at play here to have our children stray away from their mothers and their fathers. And yeah, unfortunately, so here's my test. Seems to be working.
Here's my test. If you will not give your kid a firearm at that age, do not give them a smartphone.
You think it's that dangerous?
No, I know it is. When we have seen a 200% increase in suicide for preteen women since the smartphone mobile age, we have seen a dramatic increase in teenage suicides, self-harm, hospitalizations, cocaine, alcohol usage, glorification of the worst aspects of society, the objectification of women. It's no doubt. Most people would only use – so it's kind of funny. Do I think it's – I think it could be more dangerous than a firearm. Absolutely. I mean, a firearm is only used if a bad person uses it. I know almost everybody that would have a smartphone would agree that it's made them a less human being. So if you are not willing to, if you don't trust your child to give them a firearm, then do not give them a smartphone. It's that simple. And by the way, once they're at that age, that's fine. Because it takes responsibility to be able to deal with these things. They're weapons.
And not only that, but training. You know, I look at my oldest, he's 12, and he's used a firearm. In fact, we're going hunting this afternoon. I found some turkeys on our lower property. We're going out this afternoon when you and I are done here.
And
we're
I'm a big believer in young men being able to use guns early, by the way. I think it's a very important thing.
As long as they have the structure, the guidance, the discipline, and everything that goes behind it, it's not yes, technically it is a weapon, but also it's known as a tool. But you have to know how to use the tool effectively. And I agree with that with smartphones, internet, et cetera, that you know it's only as effective as you use it. And our children are not mature enough to be able to use these effectively.
No, but I just want to reinforce the point, though. And you might have seen the documentary on Netflix, Social Dilemma, maybe not. A lot of people are talking about it. I deleted my Netflix account, but one of my friends let me see it. I cannot reinforce this point enough. These social media platforms are way more dangerous than you realize. They have algorithms that manipulate, monitor screen time, listen to your conversations, and track 12, 13, and 14-year-olds' needs, wants, interests, desires, anxieties in a very, very manipulative way. And they are social programming our children. And they've admitted to this. And so that's why I try to use that analogy of firearm versus – people usually think, what are you talking about? That's kind of provocative. No, it's 100% true. And that's the type of level that we have at this, because I'm telling you that we are creating a more anxious, depressed, and suicidal generation because of these devices.
Well said. I mean, I know that to be true. I see my kids as friends who are involved in these things that, you know, are seemingly, you know, innocuous or you know, not that dangerous. And I can see the difference. Clearly, I can see the difference, and it's a real shame. And then we bought into the lie that, you know, this is what we need to be able to operate, right? And so we introduce these things to our kids young, and becomes a trap for them.
Yeah, it's very dangerous. It's not going to end well.
Look, there's a serious problem out there. Our first responders and heroes, a lot of you listen to the show, a lot of them, you have relatives of first responders. You have to pay out of your pocket for gear for the job that you're doing. So, for example, if you're a police officer, or if your husband's a police officer, or EMS or medical worker, you have to deal with constrained budgets as it is. They're trying to defund the police, and you have to pay out of your pocket for the gear. Hunting for military or first responder discounts has usually been a total headache. My police officer friends, who are total heroes, they say they can't find the discounts they need. Big general retailers don't care about you and your sacrifices, just as long as you're just adding to the cart button, typical new age corporate America. That's what's amazing about GovX. You see, GovX works directly with brands to negotiate the best prices possible because you deserve the gear you need at the prices you've earned. Plus, you can trust that the gear you're ordering is 100% authentic, direct from the manufacturer, a huge collection of gear and apparel from popular brands, all in one convenient location. So right now, visit GovX.com. Use the promo code Kirk. If you've got a military or first responder background, visit GovX and sign up for our free for instant access to tons of deals and a community that honors your service. GovX.com, promo code Kirk.
I want to shift gears a little bit. You know, one of the first things you said is how involved and how much weight and emphasis you place on quote unquote your mission. What would you say your mission is?
I mean, I hate to phrase it this way. I'm trying to save the country. So, I mean,
from
we've been
what?
Given this incredible, from people who are not grateful that they live in this country. I mean, we have a counterinsurgency ideologically and culturally that quite honestly have a completely different vision for America. And I'm trying to save it from, I hate to be this political about it, I'm trying to save it from the bitterness and ingratitude of the left. I'm trying to save it from people that, quite honestly, they're angry that they live in America, not thankful that they live here. And I also believe very firmly that a country's ability or inability to communicate our founding values, our core values and morals to young people, that will basically predict or be the judge of whether or not your country will continue to exist. And we have things so good in this country. We have grown so comfortable. It's so convenient. It's so easy that we have no idea how easy this thing can all crumble. And I deal with the most radical voices on the left. I see their ideas being mainstreamed and platformed on a daily basis, where police departments are being defunded in Minneapolis and murder rates are up 40%, where pedophilia is being decriminalized in California, where Section 145 decriminalizes pedophilia, where I see cuties on Netflix. If this is not a fire alarm for those of us that just believe in decency and believe in normal American values, I'm obviously a conservative and I'm not unafraid to talk about it. However, if you're not even political, this should concern you because there's a disintegration happening in front of our very eyes. And so, I mean, I hate to put it in those terms, you know, save the country, but that's basically what I try to do.
Yeah, I don't think that's off. You know, and I don't think you need to hate putting it in those terms because, you know, I believe a lot.
No, I just
of that
don't want to make myself seem like wrong. I'm an Avenger character or something. But yeah, it's like I am trying to save the country. So
I mean, let's be honest. You know, a lot of us are in the industry, not only of informing, but entertaining, too. And so, you know, maybe we use some of that hyperbolic language. But, you know, I believe when you say something that you don't mean it to be inflammatory. You don't mean it to grandize. You're doing it because you genuinely believe it. And there's some integrity there. Look, there's going to be people who don't agree with me or you. I know you're a polarizing figure, but at least there's some integrity here. No, you don't try to be, but just through the nature of society, you are, right? And I think anytime you find somebody who's convicted so strongly as you are, there's going to be people who are strongly convicted in the exact opposite, and that's what makes it polarizing.
No,
but
I think that's
my
fair.
Question
no,
is,
again, I don't disagree with that. Go ahead.
Well, my question is, why the hostility? You know, like, now look, I happen to agree with a lot of what you have to say, probably 99% of what you say. But let's take the 1%, or even if it was more, I can't imagine myself being so hostile towards you or anybody else that, you know, I'd wish you violence or death or any catastrophe to fall upon you. But it seems to me that not only are we polarized, we wish violence on people. I don't understand where this is stemming from.
I mean, it's part of a belief that has grown from postmodernism in our country, where they believe dialogue and discussion is dangerous, and not just dangerous, they think it's evil. Look, there's two ways to govern human beings. Aristotle said it best. We as human beings are the speaking beings. So Aristotle, of course, the student of Plato, who is the student of Socrates, the ancient classics that built ancient Rome, kind of the birthplace of a lot of the ideas that we discuss here in the West. Aristotle famously said, what makes us different than any other creature on the planet is we can talk. We should not forget that. So there's two ways to govern humans. One way is through talking and speaking, convincing, reasoning, getting together in a room and coming together and saying, this is a bad idea. It's a good idea. Let's have some new one, some compromise. Okay. The other way is by force. I have a bigger army, a bigger sword, and I'm willing to use it. Shut up. Most of human history has been governed by force, not talking and speaking. The American idea, the American experiment, was let's govern by speaking and talking. So now we have a devolution back to this idea of governing by force. I cannot get a liberal to talk to me on my podcast. I can't find one. Why? I'll go talk on any liberal podcast. They never invite me on theirs, and they won't come on mine. They believe speech is evil. They believe that if they come talk to me, they're validating a dialogue that will only make the country less likely from being made in their image. So I want to make the differentiation between leftists and liberals. Leftists do not believe in speech. Liberals generally do. I can't find many liberals out there.
And well, it's funny you say this. I was going to say, Charlie, it's funny you say this because I know as we release this conversation between each other, I'm going to get a lot of messages like, I can't believe you'd give him a platform. Look, why wouldn't I? Why wouldn't I? Look, if your information is good, wouldn't we want to know? And if your information is bad, wouldn't we want to expose that?
But, and just tell me one thing I've said that's wrong or reprehensible and come tell me about it. That's my whole thing. I mean, just to reinforce it, I go to a college campus. I sit down there for 3 hours and anyone can come up to me with their own camera and film me and make me look like an idiot at any time. I sit there and I wait for you. And I got the inspiration from, you know, Steven Crowder, who's terrific, just sat there and said, come up to me. Got a problem with me? Talk to me about it. If we stop talking, we are going to get into brute physical conflict. I don't want that. BLM does. They're burning down cities. They're being validated by mainstream Democrats. They're being bailed out of prison. They're being told that if you have a need to loot, you can loot. They're being allowed to destroy the fabric of our society. Why don't you talk about things? Because again, you read their literature, read Michel Foucault, you read Jacques Derrida, you read Herbert Marcuse, you read the Frankfurt School literature. They believe dialogue is the problem. They took exception with Socrates. They do not think speaking is important. What you and I are doing here is healthy. It's robust. If I say something really foolish, you're going to tell me that. If you say something really good, I'm going to compliment you. Again, we are speaking beings. This is what makes us different than primates. You get rid of that, then you're going to tear each other's head off. And that's where we were for 3,000, 4,000 years. And so I'm more worried about the direction of our country than ever before, because we've completely lost that. Then we have tech companies that kick people off just because they have different opinions, which is a very real threat. And they have far too much power, these tech companies do. Something I can agree with the left on if they're actually honest about it. So yeah, look, these are legitimate things. So look, the country's not going to continue to survive at this pace. It's just not. And so it's a very dangerous trajectory.
How do you bring people to the table? You know, I mean, I think about it, for example, when people say, oh, Ryan, you're in an echo chamber. And yeah, I actually agree with that to some degree, because those who view things differently than me, and I'm sure you're experiencing this as well, like you just said, they won't talk to you. Right. And so like, I'll have you on and guys will say, well, why don't you have somebody from the left on? It's like, who?
Go find one.
Who? Like I'll talk with them. Who?
Yeah, but the left thinks that men are poisonous. I mean, just the name of your podcast, an entire political party thinks that they think your podcast name is evil. Mm-hmm. And you had Mazie Hirono during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings tell men to sit down and shut up. I mean, this is a mainstream American political party that's been trying to destroy the man for quite some time now.
So how do you bring these people to the table, though, Charlie? I mean, that's the question.
I'll give two names in particular, James Lindsay and Peter Boghossian. They're two liberals that did come on my podcast to actually bash the same things that you and I are bashing, believe it or not. They came to me saying that the left is unafraid to talk. And I guess that's the best way to do it. I'm going to keep on going into their environments to try to have these discussions. I don't know. And there's not a lot of things I'll answer with the answer I don't know, because I'm not saying I know a lot. I have an answer to a couple things. If they're unwilling to engage, if they're unwilling to lock into any form of a dialectic, it's almost a non-starter. And we're reinforcing it with our 5-year-olds and our 6-year-olds and our 7-year-olds. And it's really interesting. Back in the 80s and 90s, a big fear from the left is they would say, we can't give power to all those Christians because they're going to be fundamentalists and they're going to come after us and it's going to be a theocracy. You probably remember this period in American history.
Of course.
And the exact opposite has happened. As America became more secular and the left took power, they became evangelical, not Christian evangelical. They're the ones that are basically, they think this is like a holy war. They think, like, if you don't agree with me, I'm going to destroy your life. And kind of, if you don't agree with me, I'm kind of like, all right, whatever. That's fine, I guess. Sure. I don't obsess over it. But these people are so convinced to destroy you if you do not hold their opinion. It's incredibly pathological.
Do you, I'm just taking some notes, Charlie. So as I look down, I don't want you to think my phone or anything. I'm taking notes. But, you know, as the things you say and the situations you expose yourself to, do you fear for your safety?
Well, I mean, I get death threats. I've had to get the FBI involved. You know, we've had our house deemed, you know, targeted many different times. I can't walk on a college campus without 10 armed guards, helicopter support at times. Yeah, I have security and stuff, but these people are cowards. If they want to do something against me, whatever. I mean, that's part of the game. The physical safety piece of it, I think, is mostly bluster and empty threats. And if someone really has a problem with me, then come find me. And, you know, I'm not trying to say that in like some sort of tough guy way, but I've been kicked out of restaurants. I've been physically threatened. I've had stuff thrown at me. I've had Antifa follow me through the streets. I've had all that sort of stuff. And so when say I'm convicted, you're right. I've been fighting these people for quite some time. So.
Yeah, I think I saw, it must've been a couple of years ago, you and Candace Owens. I believe. Yep. Yeah. Were you in a restaurant or
we were in a breakfast restaurant in Philadelphia. Yeah. The Green Eggs Cafe. Minding our own business, and Antifa came into the restaurant, ran us out of the restaurant, threw objects at us. Police had to come, you know, and all white Antifa liberals screaming at a black conservative saying that she's not black. Interesting.
Yeah. Isn't that an interesting thing? I think, let's talk about that for a second. Let's talk about race. You know, I think a lot of this is the powers that would be trying to light a fire a little bit and to instigate. And you see these type of conversations. I'm really curious about your take on race just in society in general as it is currently.
Yeah, I think we're actually a lot less racist and more decent to each other than BLM Incorporated and any of the activist media would ever lead you to believe. In fact, I'll go to say that we're the least racist, most accepting country ever to exist in the history of the world, ever. And let me just go back by saying I grew up in America in 2008 to 2012. I went to high school in the suburbs of Chicago, a 53% English as a second language high school. So as a white person, I was a minority as a white person in my high school, Wheeling High School. You can look up the demographic info. It is a majority Hispanic high school. My best friends were everything from illegal aliens to immigrants from Jamaica to African Americans to blacks, you name it, right? Polish. I say this with a lot of reflection being done to this, we did not care about each other's skin color. We looked at each other as human beings, and I grew up in that post-racial America. I experienced it. I know it can happen. I lived through it. We treated each other decently. Everyone had the same opportunities as anyone else in our public high school. There was an institutional racism. There was any of that crap. It didn't exist. So that's why I take a very firm stance on this race issue. And so whatever they might say, we're systemically racist. We are not. We're absolutely not. And so they point to a couple subset of statistics. They say, well, blacks are doing worse than whites. I said, wait a second. You mean that if you look at the data, a black child married to a black child who is raised by a mother and father who stay loyally married is far more likely to succeed than a white kid that is raised by a single mother. It's that simple. Hmm. It is not a race issue. It is a father issue. And we have subsidized fatherlessness from the top down to the Great Society Act. We've emasculated fathers. We've been through that. Our public school system has been hyper-feminized. And you repeat that cycle over the last couple decades. Yeah, you're going to get the outcomes you get. That's not a racism problem. That's a family problem. And here's another great example as to how we're not a systemically racist country. And again, I lean in on these race issues, no holds barred. You know, most people are afraid to have these conversations that you're not allowed to talk as a, they're like, oh, you're not allowed to say this as a white man. I'm like, why?
Right, you're white. I'm a white straight man. And I know you've heard this more than me. Every time somebody says that, I'm like, oh, so what? I'm not allowed to have an opinion. I'm not allowed to share my perspective because I'm white and I'm straight.
Yeah.
This is ridiculous.
Well, and by the way, truth transcends skin color. So whoever believes that, you're racist. You're judging people by the color of your skin. But the greatest example of all this is Nigerian immigrants to America. Nigerian immigrants to America are the most successful immigrant ethnic group to America over the last 25 years. They're black. Mm. And they've succeeded unbelievably well. In fact, I could read an article from Aussie.com. Aussie.com, which is a left-wing publication, generally. They're partners with Vox and many others, where they say we need more Nigerian immigrants in America because they succeed at such high rates. So either Aussie, the far left-wing publication, either they hate Nigerian immigrants because they want them to come to a systemically racist country, or they actually might be looking at the same data that I am, which is that we're not systemically racist. Why do Nigerians do so well in this country? I'll tell you why. In the Nigerian culture, family is everything. Everything. Mm. In Nigeria, they have the highest birth rates of any country in Africa. They're the most populated country in Africa. The Nigerian culture, for whatever reason, and there's plenty of good books written on this, is a country and a culture of monogamous marriage, of intergenerational family supporting and living with each other, of working hard, of valuing education. So if Nigerians can do so well in this country with coming with nothing and entering with nothing, and these are liberal publications that are saying this, by the way, Bloomberg, Aussie, Vox, you name it. You can look it up. Just type in Nigerian immigrant success stories. And the data shows it. They do better than white Americans in our country. Maybe the country's not rigged for just a skin color. Maybe the country's set up to reward choices. And so I am really exhausted looking and viewing at personal people that do not understand the landscape. They don't understand the statistics or data, but they're incredibly driven emotively by a couple issues in the news that they're supposed to be outraged about, even though they know nothing about it, like the Breonna Taylor case, which is ridiculous. Made a whole video on that. Happy to dive into that if you want to, where you're told to be mad about something when the data does not reflect any bit at all whatsoever.
Well, you know, the hard part is that most of us, and look, I've fallen prey to this as well. It's like, I don't need the data. Just give me the clickbait, you know? And so you look at these titles and it's like, oh, I got everything I need. Well, no, you actually don't, because not only is there not more information buried in the article, there's more information that goes on behind the scenes that is not even in the article.
Yeah, I mean, let me tell you something we should be worried about in our country right now. We're on pace to have 500,000 less children next year than this year. That warrants a nationwide conversation. Let me tell you a real crisis in our country. It's not police officers killing black people, okay? That happens less likely than you are to be struck by lightning, just so you understand, statistically. A real crisis? 1 in 4 young people have contemplated suicide in the last 90 days, according to CDC. When no real crisis, antidepressants are now the most prescribed medication for the people under the age of 30. Alcoholism, cocaine, self-harm, hospitalizations, they're all up. You want to know a real crisis? 100,000 small businesses have gone under since March. So the media, in their hypnotic ways, the simulation, as I like to call it, they're telling you to believe the sequence of lies. And this is propagated by LeBron James and by the National Basketball Association and the National Football League and our major corporations that were systemically racist. First of all, no, we're not. Second of all, there are 280 other issues that I could list ahead of policing in America as the biggest issue in our country. Family formation, drug addiction, sedating our children, communicating our values, literacy rates. All those things matter abundantly more. As I mentioned, birth rates going down? Most people don't talk about this. Go to the Brookings Institution study from June of this last year, June or July, published by Bloomberg, civilizational collapse upcoming, the unintended consequence of the coronavirus. So we're on pace to have nearly a cut in half of our birth rate, and no one knows this.
Wow. That's interesting. You know, it's funny you say this because just last night we had some friends. I live in Maine. We had some friends come
through. Love Maine.
It's beautiful. They're from Utah. They came up here and we were talking with her. Her daughter-in-law is about to have her 101st grandchild.
Wow.
I can't even, I'm thinking about that. I'm like,
wait,
I can't
are
even
they from
fathom.
Utah?
They're from Utah, of course, right? Yeah, of course.
I think
large families.
Yeah, they're probably LDS. So yeah.
Yes, of course. And I am too. So like I completely understand that. We have large families, we bring a lot of kids into the world.
I think it's great. Don't get me wrong. I'm applauding it. I think it's awesome.
I've talked with people who are very, very concerned about bringing kids into the world in this environment. And I can't personally think of a better way to reverse the trend of society than to bring an army of young men and women who are raised in righteousness into this world to reverse the trends that we're seeing in society right now.
Completely. Yes. And so one of the major reasons why people say they're not having kids is because of fear. You're right. Number two is socioeconomic reasons. And then also just three, that we socially isolate ourselves so much, and this sounds really strange, we have more single young people than married young people. We have a crisis of young men that are afraid to approach women because they're afraid they'll be accused of something. They're uncomfortable in that kind of situation or scenario, and they have no masculinity in themselves at all whatsoever to be able to have a meaningful relationship.
Right.
So yeah, this has long-term generational consequences to it where, yeah, look, the federal, this is what people say, well, what would you do about this politically? Because I try to have somewhat of a solution for every problem. We should sell the federal lands out west to young families under the age of 30 for almost dime on a dollar to go have many children. It's that simple.
Hmm.
We should make it easier to have big families.
It sounds oversimplified, but I would have to agree. You know, I've heard
we did it
friends
before.
Of
it's
yours.
Just it's homesteading is what it is.
I mean,
millennial
and
homesteading.
That's part of the reason we moved out here. You know, we've got just under 50 acres. We moved out here. We homeschool our children, and we have for the past 2 years now. We've got big family. We've got neighbors who have big families, and I love this style. You know, one of the things I'm seeing, and I think this is very deliberate and intentional, is a dismantling not only of the family unit, but also of the church. And I think the church in a lot of ways 100%. Has replaced the family unit. That's where people gain a lot of their values from and understand how we operate successfully in society. You know, and I've heard people that you're connected with talk about how culture precedes politics, right? And this is exactly what we're talking about, a culture of family, a culture of values through the church, whether that's the LDS church or the Catholic church or some denomination of Christianity. This is where our values are derived from, and it's being dismantled right before our eyes.
Yes, and the church is now playing in a lot of different churches, and obvious, you know, exceptions are my pastor, Rob McCoy, and many others that do such a great job, you know, communicating these values, is now a lot of them are complicit in these disintegrationist movements of our country. So,
well, I think we bought into the notion as a Christian, that somehow, I don't think it would be this deliberate, but almost that we're supposed to be weak as opposed to meek. And that's actually the reason I reached out to you. I've had you on my radar for a long time because I followed what you're doing. And I listened to the conversation last week or a couple of weeks ago that you had with Pastor Rob. And I thought, man, I really got to pull the trigger on this and get Charlie on the podcast.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, man. What you guys shared was so, so powerful. And I love to hear not only from you, but from Pastor Rob, strong Christian men who are unafraid to share your perception of the way that we can make this society better. And it seems like there's a lot of Christians out there who are afraid to do it.
And it's a question of how do you want yourself to be governed? It's a question of civil society is not a place where Christians should compartmentalize our worldview. We should be actively involved in it. And so in California, when they're passing SB 145, which decriminalizes pedophilia, and the American church is generally silent on that, we'll be judged for that. Oh my goodness, will we be judged for that? And so, you know, I can go through a variety of different reasons and disappointments and struggles with that, but the American church needs to rise up in huge numbers right now. And if your pastor still has your church closed or is bowing to BLM Incorporated or this lie of systemic racism or critical race theory, leave that church. Do it respectfully and do it lovingly. Get out. It is not worthy your time or your tithes.
I actually saw a video just before you and I hopped on the call of he must have been a pastor of a church, and he was outside in what looked like a parking lot, and there was circles spray painted in the parking lot, and they were distanced. And so he had his congregation there. Well, the video was him being arrested. You know, his congregation was there. They were singing hymns. They were worshiping.
That's in Idaho.
Was being arrested. Is that where it was? Okay, because apparently because he had, I don't know, no mask on, or because he congregated all these people.
Whatever
the reason was.
Crazy. Yeah, and look, they're going to keep – and by the way, BLM Incorporated can march through the streets and destroy and savage our cities and act like thugs and criminals, and they don't get arrested for that. But pastors open their church, and they get criminalized, and they get arrested for that. Man, it's time for the church to wake up to this.
Well, and I think this is where the silent majority needs to stop being so silent. You know, I think of myself, and I'm like, you know, I just want really, here's what I want, Charlie. I want to be left alone. I want to do my work. I want to raise my kids. I want to work my land, and I just want to have some experiences with a little money in the bank account. That's it. And if you could just leave me alone to do that, that would be fine. And traditionally, that's been the case for the last almost four decades of my life. It seems to me that there's a real reason for me to stop being so silent and actually get involved at this point.
Yeah, and we have an opportunity to do that in November. And I'll tell you that if you want to be left alone and work your land, Joe Biden's not your guy. I'll tell you that. But, you know, President Trump, he has delivered amazing results for our country. And it really is a referendum on what kind of country we want to live in, one that respects speech and wants to go about our differences in a civil way, or one that you want to take to the streets. And so that's what I'll be working on from now to the election.
I have no doubt you will. Hey, personal question for you. You seem to be somebody who is very, very, very well researched. You have all this information. Obviously, you're an intelligent human being. How do you balance being well researched, but then also taking so much time to be able to articulate and communicate that with the public? Because sometimes it seems like those are at odds with each other. I can either research or I can communicate. How do you balance that out for yourself?
Yeah, every night I turn off my phone and I do at least an hour and a half to 2 hours of reading and research, watching lectures, reading great books, listening, you know, reading good articles and thoughtful scholarship. And then I try to bring that over into the next day. And so just was working through Aristotle recently, which is where I kind of derived some of my comments today, where I found what he taught, you know, spoke about speaking, kind of funny, so important. And so I tell everyone, read more and speak less. It's very important. So if I'm doing 3 hours of podcasting a day, I should be reading more than that. And that's a lot of time. You know, I value scholarship and research a lot. And again, I'm constantly learning. The more I learn, the more I realize how little I knew when I thought I knew it all.
You talk about it being a lot of time, but it's no more time than any other man, myself included, has in a day. It's just how we spend it.
That's right. That's exactly right. So,
well, Charlie, I want to be respectful of your time on that note and just let you know I appreciate what you're doing. I appreciate your willingness to share in the face of an uphill battle at times, it seems like, but a noble fight for sure. So thank you for joining us. Thank you for doing what you do. And I really appreciate you being willing to share
the
courageousness of that as well.
I appreciate it. Talk to you soon. Thank you.
Thanks, brother.
Email us your questions, freedom@charliekirk.com, freedom@charliekirk.com. Get involved with Turning Point USA at tpusa.com, tpusa.com. Email us, as always, freedom@charliekirk.com. Your subscription to The Charlie Kirk Show. Type in Charlie Kirk Show to your podcast provider. Hit subscribe. Give us a 5-star review, and we'll send you a signed copy of the New York Times bestseller MAGA Doctrine if you are 10 lucky people. Type in Charlie Kirk Show, hit subscribe, and please consider supporting us at charliekirk.com/support, charliekirk.com/support. If this podcast has impacted you in any way, please consider supporting us, charliekirk.com/support. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. God bless. Talk to you soon.